From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. After serving for nearly three decades on the U.S. Supreme Court, Justice Stephen Breyer last week announced he would retire. That means President Biden has the opportunity to nominate a justice during his presidency. Yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press, Chuck Todd asked Illinois Senator Dick Durbin what he thought of some of the potential nominees, including Ketanji Brown Jackson, a judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and a former Breyer clerk.
The White House made it clear when they told me about the Breyer vacancy that they had not, the president had not made the decision, and I want to respect that. I think suggesting there's a front runner or this person is now moving ahead, it's unfair to all the nominees. This is in the hands of the president, as it should be.
Durbin, of course, is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, so he will have a significant role in vetting and the Senate confirmation process for the President Biden's nominee. And of course, we do not know yet who President Biden will nominate, but we do know he's reiterated since Breyer's retirement that he would make good on a campaign promise to nominate the first black woman to the nation's highest court. We're going to get more Illinois reactions now to the Breyer retirement announcement and what it means for the future of justice in America. We're joined by Tonya Jacoby, a professor at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law. She has a PhD in political science from Stanford, a master's from UC Berkeley, and a law degree with first-class honors from the Australian National University. She specializes in judicial behavior and strategy in public law. Tonya, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
Also with us is Nakia Crossley. She worked as a lawyer for the Illinois Commerce Commission, then as Central Region Director and Counsel for the Solar Energies Industry Association. She's currently the president of the Black Woman Lawyers Association of Greater Chicago. Nakia, welcome to the 21st to you as well.
Thank you very much.
And finally, also with us is Carolyn Shapiro. She's a professor at the Chicago Kent College of Law and the founder and co-director of Chicago Kent's Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States, iSCOTUS. She also served as clerk to Justice Stephen Breyer from 96 to 97. Carolyn, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can join our conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21st show at 21st show. So, Carolyn Shapiro, I want to begin with you. Can you just tell us a little bit about what it was like being a clerk for Justice Breyer?
Well, it's the best job maybe ever. Justice Breyer is a person with an incredibly curious and active mind, and he's one of these people who thinks by talking out loud. So he would talk to us all the time about the cases that the Supreme Court was hearing, and he was always really interested in what his law clerks had to say, which is not to say that we could tell him what to do. That was not the case. But he was just always interested in probing and asking more questions and getting more information. And he was also incredibly kind and really, really deeply committed to the institution of the court, but also to the government, a functioning government as a whole. That is what he thinks the court's role is to help support a responsive and effective democracy.
No, I'm so curious about the inner workings of the court. Are you having lunch with him? Are you in working out of his office most of the time? What's it like on a daily, sort of day by day?
Yeah, so we, on a day-by-day basis, we would often have lunch with him. We would have working lunches in chambers. The layout was there were three large rooms. One was his office, the secretary's office, then the clerk's room, and then where two of us were, and then the rest of us were elsewhere in the building, and we'd switch off during the year. But whenever he was in town, if he didn't have other plans, we would eat lunch with him in the clerk's room. All of us, and they were working lunches, so we would talk about whatever interesting cases were going on, whatever he was thinking about at the time. But they were pretty work focused. We would help him just to give you a little more concrete information about what we would do. In addition to helping the court in general make decisions about what cases they would hear in Justice Breyer's chambers, we would do what are called bench memos. We would write long memos for him about each case before oral argument and then discuss them with him. He would often tell us some issues he wanted us to address. He would say, I think I'm curious about this, or I don't think the briefs adequately address that. Be sure to talk about it. But we could also talk about whatever else we thought was important. And he was always interested in that. And then when it was time for him to write opinions, we would do first drafts. But unlike some justices who just kind of touch up what their law clerks write, he would sort of use ours almost like a research memo and then toss them to the side and start from scratch. And he'd write his in his voice, and we had a supporting role.
So Tonya, let me bring you into the conversation now. How was Justice Breyer viewed as a justice? What do you think his legacy is going to be?
Well, I think he's renowned for being a moderate liberal. So he was always on a conservative court. So he did end up dissenting a lot, but he was somebody who has been very, very practical, very pragmatic, searching for solutions and searching for compromise across party lines. And I know a lot of politicians say that they're going to do that, but Justice Breyer really would try and do that. So he was the liberal justice who most often voted with the conservatives. He would try and find a means for finding agreement. And so he was renowned for being a moderate liberal and also just very pragmatic. And what I mean by that is, in contrast to, you know, the classic extreme of Justice Scalia, who was very typically very formalist and would focus on, you know, the placement of a comma in a sentence, for example, Justice Breyer is very much about looking for practical solutions and finding what Congress, if he was interpreting legislation, what the real purpose was. And if they'd made sort of if they hadn't written the legislation very well, he would still say, okay, well, what are they actually trying to do here? How can we find a good solution for the legislative goal that was at issue here? Or if he's interpreting the Constitution, it was like, what is actually going to be best for the country that is consistent with what the Constitution says, but also guided by what the impact of any decision is going to be? So it's very much sort of looking at outcomes in a pragmatic way. But I think there are different ways of being pragmatic in that way. So Justice Kennedy, for example, was very sort of very confident that he knew all the answers and he would find what he thought was the best pragmatic solution because he knew best. Whereas I think Justice Breyer had a much more inquiring mind and was looking for solutions, but not necessarily assuming that he knew best. He would look at the record. He would look at, you know, what was written. He would look at amicus briefs and so on. And so he was very curious. And I shouldn't talk about it in the past tense, he's alive and well, but as a justice coming to the end of his reign, I think he really encaptured that sense of trying to find solutions to make government and society work well.
And what I think the big picture you're talking about there is this idea of active constitution, right? That's something as opposed to a document frozen in amber or on parchment, however you want to think of it. He felt that, you know, the constitution was flexible enough that it could be reinterpreted generation by generation as society changed. Is that a fair
argument? Absolutely. Rather than reifying what was, you know, what type of gun people carried 200 years ago, he would look at, okay, what were the founders generally trying to do? And what he believed the Constitution, the overall theme of the Constitution, was to protect rights, and that over time there has been this historical development towards expansion of those rights. So just as we've seen the franchise expand to include people of different races, women, people who are under 21, and so on, the direction has always been to expand rights. He thought that that was very much the theme of the Constitution. So when in doubt, if there's a constitutional provision, you should interpret it in a way that is most protective of the public and the public's fundamental rights. And so he would call that active liberty, in contrast to negative liberty, where it's like, well, you have the power to stop me doing actual harm, but otherwise, you know, we can't say what is required. And he's like, no, let's try and interpret this in a way that maximizes people's rights and freedoms.
If I could just jump in.
Yeah, please.
I agree with everything Tonya just said. I just would add that he saw one of the other things he thought the Constitution was about being able find a way that we as a nation could solve our problems collectively. Mm. And he talked about that in his speech at the White House the other day, about how we had collectively made a commitment to solving our problems and our disagreements through law. But one of the things that means for him is that we have to allow for the problems to be solved. We can't be too restrictive in terms of, for example, what the limits on the federal government's ability to act, because then we're not solving our national problems. And then the law, the Constitution is not in fact serving its one of its most important purposes, while at the same time, of course, as Tanya talks about, protecting and continuing to protect people's fundamental rights.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce my guests for this part of our show today. If you're just joining us, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. You just heard there from Carolyn Shapiro, who's a professor at Chicago Kent College of Law and was a clerk to Justice Breyer in the late 1990s. She also served as Solicitor General of Illinois a few years back. We're also speaking with Tonya Jacoby, a professor at Northwestern University's Law School, who specializes in judicial behavior and strategy in public law, and also Nakia Crossley, who is the president of the Black Women Lawyers Association of Greater Chicago. Nakia, I want to bring you into the conversation now, because we want this to be both retrospective about Justice Breyer, but also forward-looking. And a lot of that has to do with a promise President Biden made during his campaign, and he reiterated last week when Justice Breyer announced his retirement. Let's listen to a clip.
Choosing someone to sit in the Supreme Court, I believe, is one of the most serious constitutional responsibility a president has. Our process is going to be rigorous. I will select a nominee worthy of Justice Breyer's legacy of excellence and decency. While I've been studying candidates' backgrounds and writings, I've made no decision except one. The person I will nominate will be someone with extraordinary qualifications, character, experience, and integrity. And that person will be the first Black woman ever nominated to the United States Supreme Court.
Nikki, I wonder, what was your reaction to Biden's campaign promise and also Justice Breyer's retirement?
Well, you know, I think it's extremely positive. I mean, the fact is that Americans are not a monolith. It's a melting pot of different cultures, religions, customs, and lived experiences. And I think it's way past due for a Supreme Court that actually reflects society. I mean, a Black woman on the Supreme Court will have an identity that has never before been shared by anyone who has held the seat. Out of its 200-year history, all who have sat on the U.S. Supreme Court, I believe minus seven, have been white and male, and three have been people of color. Wow. People of color make up approximately 40% of America's population. So I think that given that the Supreme Court is historically and rather substantially affected what it means to be Black in America on issues such as voting rights and the integration of our educational system, among many other matters, this is the time is right, I believe.
Can you say a little more about that idea of representation on the bench in our nation's judges? Because I think that, you know, judges like to say they're sort of blank slates. That's why they all wear the same color robe and everything. But obviously a background plays into that. Can you just talk about what, you know, representation can bring to a judge's approach to their work?
Well, I think we've seen many studies, right, that have shown that diversity on the bench, particularly one that reflects the community it serves, increases fairness of outcomes, especially when you think about, for example, the criminal justice system, where defendants are proportionately Black and Hispanic. It's vital. I mean, it's vital to have a diversity of experience, because they do, I believe, inherently affect the decisions that are made.
Absolutely. And I want to take a moment to say our call-in number again. If you have a question or you want to join our conversation today with a comment, 800-222-9455 is the number, 800-222-9455. Or you can always tweet us at 21st Show, at 21ST Show. We need to take a break in about a minute here. But before we do, Tonya Jacoby, let me ask you, is this new justice expected to change the balance of the court in any significant way?
not the ideological balance. We have a very solid six justice conservative coalition and three liberals. And so Justice Breyer will presumably be replaced by someone who's liberal as well. But I do think it's very important to have diversity on the bench and also to have change on the bench. I'll be very sad to see Justice Breyer leave, and perhaps we can talk about his sense of humor as well when we come back. But at the same time, it'll be wonderful to have the first Black woman on the bench and the different views that that brings. And that will contribute mightily to the court being representative, to being younger, and to having sort of turnover that we don't have as much as we should. Like, a lot of the justices stay on until they're very old, and don't really represent the country in that sense either.
All right, those are some great ideas. We're going to talk more about all that when we come back. We are talking about Justice Stephen Breyer's decision to retire from the United States Supreme Court and President Biden's vow to nominate a Black woman as the first Black woman justice on the U.S. Supreme Court as his successor. 800-222-9455 is the number. This is the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about Justice Stephen Breyer's decision to retire from the United States Supreme Court and President Biden's vow to nominate the first Black woman as his successor, first Black woman justice as his successor. We're speaking about that with Carolyn Shapiro, who's a professor at Chicago Kent College of Law and was a clerk to Justice Breyer from 1996 to 1997. Also, Tonya Jacoby, a professor at Northwestern University's Law School, who specializes in judicial behavior and strategy in public law. We're also speaking with Nakia Crossley, who worked for the Illinois Commerce Commission, the Solar Energies Industry Association, and is currently the president of the Black Women Lawyers Association of Greater Chicago. And Nikki, I want to ask you, last Friday, more than 100 Black women leaders sent a letter to the White House praising President Biden's decision to nominate a Black woman to the court. But they also said in this letter that they're ready to mobilize during this confirmation process because they are already anticipating it's going to be arduous for the nominee. Republicans are already labeling this person, who, again, has not yet been selected, but they're labeling him as radical. Are you anticipating a difficult confirmation process?
Well, I'd expect any process to be rigorous, as President Biden stated. But I do recognize, in the vein of that letter, that historically African American women lawyers have faced and exceeded barriers and glass ceilings as it pertains to the legal profession. So I think it is to be expected, but I believe that we have a promising path.
Go ahead, please. Yeah,
that was me, Carolyn Shapiro. I just wanted to add that one of the talking points I've heard, which I find really disturbing, is the notion that by announcing that he's going to nominate a Black woman, the president is somehow not considering some of the, you know, he's leaving out candidates he somehow should be considering. And I think it's just incredibly important to say that the Black women who are on the shortlist or whose names are being discussed are absolutely outstanding and highly qualified. And that there is no single person in the country who is somehow deserving of or most qualified for any Supreme Court nomination. So taking into account the need for broader representation on the court is utterly legitimate. President Reagan did that with Justice O'Connor and Justice Scalia, the first Italian American on the court. President Eisenhower did that with Justice Brennan, the first Catholic on the court. I mean, so it's not the case that this is there's something new and particularly unusual about this pledge. And the people that there is a wealth of amazing and outstanding candidates that the president is considering.
Well, and if I could add something as
please.
Well,
yeah, go ahead.
Tanya, just that social science studies have looked into this, and better decisions are made by groups when they represent a diverse coalition of backgrounds. So people bring different things to the table if they have different biographies, and decision-making can actually be improved by having more diversity. So it's not just a question of finding the absolute best person in the country, but it's the best person who can bring something new as well to the discussion is a very valuable contribution.
Well, and Tanya, that's a great point. And I wanted to ask you, and Carolyn mentioned this as well, but this idea of a designated seat on the court for representation, it's not a new phenomenon, right? And there has been a lot of talk about the so-called Jewish seat on the court. I mean, this is, when you have diverse coalitions, this is not new, right?
Yeah, and I will say that there's been more of a history of having Jewish justices than they have of having Black justices, and certainly of having Black female justices. And as mentioned, we've had a very small handful of women ever being on the court. So I think even if we want to consider diversity, we have to be diverse within our diversity as well.
Sure. And one aspect of diversity that has been discussed among some of the more nerdier sectors of online discussion of the court, Carolyn, is that there are some of the finalists, or how would you say, not finalists is not the right phrase, but some of the names that have been floated as potential successors to Justice Breyer are state Supreme Court justices, right? California,
yes.
South Carolina. And I understand there has not been a state judge appointed to the high court since Sandra Day O'Connor. And you were Solicitor General of Illinois. For people who may not be familiar, that's the sort of chief appellate lawyer for the state in the attorney general's office. Do you think a state court background would add something valuable to the mix of the high court?
I do. I think you have a different perspective when you come out of a state court system and understand the way state law operates. There are decisions that the court makes that sometimes involve assumptions about the way states operate that may or may not be entirely accurate. So I think there's a lot of what could be a lot of value to that. I don't, there are other types of characteristics that aren't represented on the court that would be valuable. For example, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, who's one of the names that's been mentioned. She's a federal judge, but she was a federal public defender. I don't think we've ever had a federal public defender on the court, much less, or a criminal defense lawyer, certainly not in any recent years. That would be another remarkably valuable perspective.
Yeah, as opposed to people who'd worked mostly on the prosecutor side of,
correct.
Of the criminal defense, but yeah, criminal law. Nikki, how do you think this representation on the court might affect decisions that affect women in the future?
Well, yeah, as I've stated before, I think that increased diverse representation across the board really, as I think was stated here before, will enhance the quality of the decisions that are being made. And so I think having that perspective of a Black woman on the bench will increase that experience all the more.
Tanya, there's been talk in this conversation and out there in the world about Justice Breyer being an institutionalist, right? He cares about the institution of the court and the judiciary. Do you have thoughts on that ideology and whether those values and the way people view the court are changing?
I think that's a really topical question. There's a big disconnect between the general views of the public and the current makeup of the court. The court is much more conservative than the average American. And some of the decisions that they're making are controversial in that they're disregarding prior precedent. So you can get mugs saying things like stare decisis is for suckers, which is basically saying we don't follow our own rules. So it is a very pertinent question at the moment, because while I think the Chief Justice is also very concerned with the legitimacy of the court, I think that the other five conservatives are sort of perhaps enjoying their large block, their voting block at the moment, and are looking for cases to reverse. And, you know, Roe v. Wade is the most obvious one that comes to mind, but there are other issues where the court doesn't seem to be following its own rules. And so that does really raise concerns about judicial legitimacy. People are talking a lot about Supreme Court reform and court reform in general of the lower courts as well. So it's a very topical question. And I think Justice Breyer was very much of the approach, let's take small steps, let's be careful of our institutions. And I hope that whoever the new nominee is will take that approach as well, because I think that's very valuable. It's a way of respecting tradition without being time bound, but it's taking what is valuable in the U.S. political system and trying to protect it.
Carolyn Shapiro, I wonder what you have, if you have a perspective on that and the way the view of the court is shifting, and whether it, you know, could face a legitimacy crisis in the future if it is, you know, continues dispensing with precedent.
I think that there's a real possibility of that. The court, the conservative majority has shown itself to be willing to do some really quite radical things, some of which have been, we've already seen, for example, by dispensing with the mandate, the OSHA mandate that large employers require their employees to be either vaccinated or to be masked and test. That they do appear to be poised to overrule Roe versus Wade, just to name a couple of examples. And the likelihood that the conservative majority is going to continue to attack reproductive rights, voting rights, and to promote religious freedom over other rights in a rather significant way. May very well lead to a legitimacy crisis, because as Tanya says, those positions are not consistent with the views of the average American.
Okay, well, we are going to continue to follow this confirmation process. I want to thank Tanya Jacoby, who is a professor at Northwestern's Pritzker School of Law, Carolyn Shapiro, who is a professor and co-director of Chicago Kent's Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States, and Nakia Crossley, who is the president of the Black Women Lawyers Association of Greater Chicago. Thank you all so much for being here and sharing your perspectives with us today on the 21st.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.